Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Lindsay Mazza and Dragana Lick will be telling us a little bit about their disabilities work. So what can you tell me about your work as it relates to disabilities?
Are you talking to me or Lindsay, or how are you going to start?
We can take it in whatever order you like.
Lindsay, would you like to start?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, hi. So I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for going on 13 years, and somebody with a disability myself. And I was a family law lawyer, but left the active practice of law in the traditional sense to do disability advocacy work. And that has taken me, on a road of doing consulting for inclusion and working with clients to have their story told and heard and help them advocate publicly to share their stories of discrimination and the barriers that they face as somebody living with a disability or somebody with family members with a disability. And that's how Dragana and I connected. She has a very powerful story to share where her son was directly impacted with discrimination, and her and I have been working together on getting that story told.
So, Dragana, can you tell me a little bit about your son's story?
Yes. I would like first just to shortly introduce myself and all my family, because we have three disabled people in the family. I have a disability. I'm a single sight deaf person. They never know why that happened. It seems I had a small stroke and left over the night single sight deaf person. I have learning disability myself and ADHD, and my both kids are neurodivergent as well. They're neurodivergent people. My both kids have ADHD and learning disability. One of my sons had a terrible motorcycle accident 5 years ago, which left him disabled. This story is about my son, Damian, who suffered from terrible discrimination and terrible injustice from one of Ontario colleges. Damian was a student, is a student with learning disability and ADHD. However, as many neurodivergent people, he's extremely smart person, and he was very successful in different domain of his life. Just a second, please. My cat is here. Damian, as a neurodivergent person, is very talented and very, very successful boy. He was very successful during his school years. He completed Mayfield Caledon High School with dual diploma. And he's very active in acting, in TV shows, and he has black belt in Kung Fu. This is a short introduction that this is a boy who is talented and who is dedicated to his work, his school, his passion. Unfortunately, when Damian started his college, Canada College in Ontario, as a program for respiratory therapies, he disclosed his medical condition. He disclosed that he has learning disability and ADHD. He He applied to the college with all documentation that he had, and he was accepted, and he was doing pretty well. Damon completed all courses from his college. However, it took him, as they mentioned, longer than it was supposed to be. They're saying it was supposed to be, even though there is no time limit for that course. He completed 2 years of studying over 4 years. He was successful. He completed all the exams. However, they called that against him, like making private comments verbally after the class that he has to maybe think about quitting because even though, this is quotation, even though you completed all the courses and you were eventually successful, it took you longer. And then they mentioned verbally, you have very high anxiety, we notice that, we don't think this is very good, I mean, to choose this profession because you have high anxiety. I'm just mentioning the comments that were Damon was receiving last 3 to 4 years, Cameron. Yeah. Basically, not only he had to put more effort to complete all the courses, more effort than other students, but he was facing such a terrible discrimination that, you know, it was like ruining his self-esteem.
So,
and so it was something that, yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt there. So I'm just wondering, do you have any advice for parents out there and families who have members who have disabilities and are facing these sorts of challenges?
Yes, I do have advice. I have advice for parents to be involved in kids' school as much as possible. You should not rely on the written rules about inclusion. You should not rely about written rules and paragraphs about accommodation. You should be very involved. You should watch everything closely. And one most important advice, unfortunately, you have to collect the evidence even before something happens. You have to be very aware. You should collect kids' marks, good comments, something that can be very valuable in the future if something like this happens.
So what are your next steps forward to right this injustice?
After all discrimination, just like to mention, this is not all. He kept studying. And the point is, only 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks before graduation, Damien was brutally expelled. He was expelled verbally, only verbally, over via Zoom meeting, the college dean. He was expelled because after 5 years of studying, 3 weeks before graduation, he received mark less than 80, it was 70-something. Damien and we were expecting that he is going to get a chance to have academic probation, to have a learning plan, and that the rules are going to be followed. Unfortunately, no. He had a Zoom meeting with the college dean. I was present as well. And the Zoom meeting started with very humiliating comments, like, we are aware of your condition. And he was verbally expelled 2 weeks before graduation.
It's horrible.
Yes, he did not have right on learning plan, on academic probation. At the time that he was expelled, and we have everything documented, everything in his transcripts, official transcripts, that year, last year, he wasn't on academic probation. He wasn't on learning plan. He has not received one single concern letter, which is mandatory in process like that. Not only that, they even didn't give him a chance to appeal. They skipped appeal 1 and 2 process. And it was such a big shock. After that, he received an email. However, they were very careful, and they did not put an email that he is expelled. Expulsion was only verbal. Whole communication with college was blocked, and that's why we found a lawyer. Unfortunately, lawyer couldn't help. The college didn't answer to lawyer's emails. they rejected appeal, and that's how we started very, very long litigation process to fight for Damien's right.
So, Lindsay, do you have any thoughts as to what you'd like the public to know about having equal rights and how to stand on them?
Yeah, so I just want to be clear that I'm not the one representing Dragana in a legal capacity. She has a lawyer helping her with that. But in terms of, I think the main message that we've been trying to hammer home is that, you know, equality is so far from being achieved within Canada. And I think that people who don't have direct experience with disability think that there are all of these safety measures in place to protect people from discrimination, but those that are met with barriers know more than, you know, anyone that they, it's really a flawed system. You know, Damien was, he's attending a college where there is a right to accommodation and accessibility should be met, but he received discrimination and there was no recourse, or he experienced discrimination, there was no recourse for him at the college level. And then beyond that, taking matters to, you know, the legal level, it was very clear that at the judicial level that discrimination continues there as well, because there's a complete lack of understanding when it comes to disability. So these measures that are in place don't actually protect people with disabilities. We have to be proactive instead of reactive, because Damien is now years out and still no resolution.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Esther Kane will be telling us about AFTD. So what can you tell me about your work with AFTD?
Yeah, hello. So my name is Esther Kane, and I am AFTD's Director of Support and Education. AFTD is a nonprofit patient advocacy organization whose mission is to improve the quality of life for people impacted by FTD and to really drive research towards a cure. I've been with AFTD now for about 5 years, and my role at AFTD is really to support family caregivers, support people diagnosed, educate health providers about what is FTD, understanding the complexities of the disease and how people need to be cared for, and really trying to raise awareness and understanding of what FTD is, how it differs from Alzheimer's disease, and really help the families be seen, because very often families feel very unseen in the FTD process.
So for those who might not be familiar with the condition, how does it typically impact a person?
So FTD is a neurodegenerative disease of the brain that typically affects the frontal and temporal lobes. What we typically see in FTD is changes in behavior and personality, communication changes, and movement changes. Very often, FTD affects people at a younger age, so it's not uncommon for people to be diagnosed in their 50s or 60s, and is very often misdiagnosed and misunderstood by health providers.
So how does the association reach out to those who could potentially benefit from your work?
Yeah, so AFTD, one of our main mission pillars is support and trying to reach families and provide information. So we have a helpline, and our helpline is staffed by trained social workers. And last year alone, they actually talked to over 4,000 families who were impacted by the disease. We also oversee a support group network throughout the country. We have over 100 affiliated support groups that specifically tackle issues of FTD, whether they are caregiver support groups, groups for people diagnosed, support mechanisms for LGBTQ+ caregivers, or people who are specifically dealing with language issue, male caregiving, the list goes on. In addition, we do a lot of resources and information to help families navigate the disease. So we have publications on things like life after FTD, which helps people kind of know what steps to take after a diagnosis. We have resources and supports for people who are dealing with kids and teens at home, as well as information about genetics. About a third of all cases of FTD actually have a family history of FTD and have what in some cases is considered a genetic link. And so that goes from family to family. We also have a pretty extensive CompStop grant program. And this grant program is really designed to be able to provide respite grants for caregivers to help give them a break. And then we have quality of life grants for people diagnosed to be able to purchase items or things that can improve their quality of life. And those are just a few examples of the way that we support caregivers.
So you mentioned it's often misdiagnosed. How do you go about clearing up any myths or misconceptions concerning the condition?
Yeah, so AFCD actually developed these diagnostic checklists within the last couple of years. We have them for the various forms of the disease. And what they really do is on one side talk about what the families might be seeing in terms of symptoms. And on the other side, they have the clinical diagnostic criteria. So one of the big gaps is that sometimes what the families are seeing and what we see as dementia don't always match up. The age is off, the behaviors don't look like dementia behaviors, and so they end up going through, they don't get on the right referral train to get to the right neurologist in order to get an accurate diagnosis. It's very often misdiagnosed as depression, Alzheimer's disease, psychosis. In some people, they're misdiagnosed with Parkinson's disease or other movement symptoms. And so really right now, one of our initiatives at AFTD is really support the work of finding biomarkers in FTD. Recently, we've developed blood-based biomarker tests in Alzheimer's disease, which has really been revolutionary to the entire field. And AFTD is really pushing to find blood-based biomarkers in FTD so that we will be able to better diagnose it earlier and get people on the right track for diagnosis as well as care.
So in your time with AFTD, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
There's so many. I'd have to, like, think for a moment about my favorite, but there really has been so many. I think the thing that always speaks to me the most is when people finally feel seen, when caregivers or people diagnosed say to us that before they came to AFTD, they felt like they were drowning, and all of a sudden they had an arm come down and pull them up. And for me and for most of my team, that really just helps us feel like our work is mattering. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to pull these families out of the pit of despair, the loneliness, the confusion, the lack of information, and give them the supports that they need so that they can walk forward. And I feel like that usually is the message that gives us the hope and the vision to keep trotting forward.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by FTD?
So we think this is really underestimated because we don't have clear biomarkers because it's very often misdiagnosed. Because so many people with dementia are actually just given a broad dementia or MCI diagnosis and don't really know the subtype they're dealing with, we don't know if there's actually accurate numbers out there. But current best estimates say about 50,000 to 60,000 people living in the U.S. right now are diagnosed with FTD.
Like, thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadian Blood Services invites you to save a life today. Every 60 seconds, someone in Canada needs blood. Donating is simple, and your blood will go to help Canadians undergoing heart surgery, leukemia treatment, or those involved in an accident. Go online and book your appointment today at www.blood.ca or give us a call toll-free at 1-888-2-DONATE. That's 1-888-236-6283.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Esther Kane told us a little bit about AFTD, and we heard about an ongoing disability justice matter from Brigana Lidge and Lindsay Mazza. In this segment of our show, Amy Richardson will be telling us a little bit about her prosthetics work. So what can you tell me about your work in the prosthetics field?
So I work in prosthetics, actually. So my background is that I'm a graduate from George Brown College's Clinical Methods and Prosthetics Orthotics programs. So we learned both disciplines in school, and then I chose prosthetics to specialize in and do my residency upon graduation, and then became a certified clinician practicing with individuals who are either born with limb differences or have acquired limb amputations. On the clinical side, and I've worked in that practice for a number of years, but I'm also full-time faculty with the George Brown College.
In this work, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning prosthetics?
Yeah, I think there's often, we're a really small, unique field, so I think usually when, especially when we're experiencing or working with patients or clients for the first time who maybe don't have had much personal exposure, they're often relying on what they've seen in media or on social media or film or television. And quite often how prosthetic limbs are displayed in those settings can not be the realities that our clients and the technology currently face. So sometimes they overemphasize the function and the ability and the kind of things prosthetic devices do, or sometimes the portrayal hasn't really been informed by people with those lived experiences, and it's not really a realistic portrayal that way either.
So for your work to educate young minds as they go into the field, how do you speak to those myths and stereotypes? How do you challenge media perception versus true information?
Yeah, I think especially on the education side for prosthetics, orthotics, and in general, we're always challenging our students to think about their sources and where they're getting information, and just to be critical thinkers and problem solvers. So whether that's media that's maybe unintentionally portraying something that's not accurate, or if they're looking at a manufacturer's information, then being able to use their critical thinking skills and other empirical evidence-based resources to tease out what is function and fact versus what might just be marketing and promotional material. And so it's really creating really qualified clinicians and technicians to work in our profession that are going to utilize their educational experience as well as evidence from the research and evidence from the clients and patients that they're working with to inform their treatment choices and the practice.
I assume that would include making sure the information is current and relevant, because when it comes to what was available as a prosthetic 50 years ago, that's obviously not what we're looking at today.
Correct. Yeah, and we start sort of from the beginning of the program with the students, really to provide them sort of those foundational knowledges, and everything that we do is rooted in sort of science-based evidence, right? So whether it's human anatomy and physiology, a lot of biomechanical principles, and having those foundational skills and then applying them to each individual sort of unique needs and their personal goals, and then teaching them the skills to be able to research and look for what sort of new technology might be available to help supplement or inform those, that treatment planning, which is sort of what we describe that whole process, right? As certified prosthetists and orthotists, we, as part of our care to our patients, it requires providing a prosthetic device, but there's so much more that goes into our treatment than just that device, right? There's the assessment of the patient, identifying the goals, looking how that device interfaces with the person, with their environment. So providing education to our patients, to their families or caregivers. So there's a whole big component, and that device is a very important part of our treatment, but not the only thing that we do. And it's educating our students as well to be aware of that and then be able to be good advocates for their field and the patients and clients.
So I assume that would include things like changes to a patient's needs, such as I heard recently that, say, if someone becomes pregnant, the changes to the body would, of course, change the fit of the prosthetic.
Yeah, absolutely. We're creating a prosthetic socket, which is custom, and that's what interfaces directly with that patient's limb. And that arguably is the most important part of that prosthetic device, and how intimately that fits really directly correlates to that individual's comfort and their function and their ability to be full participants in their daily lives. And we're creating these devices that are pretty static, and we know the human body is very dynamic and undergoes changes, whether it's a pregnancy. We all undergo variations in performing fluctuations on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis, you know, weight loss, weight gain, or change in medical conditions. So there's a multitude of different things that can influence how a prosthesis fits. And so for sure, as prosthetists and prosthetic technicians, there will be assessment and adjustments to those devices. It's not always making something new. So the clinician will typically be working with the client to assess how that device is fitting in that moment and sort of determining what changes are needed, and then often collaborating with their technical team members to implement and execute those changes.
So in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, on the personal clinical practice, I've had, you know, there's so many moments where I've been able to help clients achieve their goals. And that can be such a broad spectrum of things in terms of what an individual goal is. And when you see them reach that, that's really what sort of keeps me going and gets me excited for kind of the next encounter. Some of those, from an example, could be something is working with an elderly woman who underwent an amputation, and the goal was for her to be ambulatory enough to stay in her home, right? She knew that there was going to be care that needed to be provided and assistance, but the goal was to be able to be functional so she could ambulate in her home, make herself her afternoon cup of tea, and not have to go into assisted living. Another example might be working with some of the pediatric clients that I'm fortunate to work with to get them up and skiing. I had a kid that went skiing for the first time a few weeks ago. So those goals and patient goals can be so broad, but each of them are all really individual and important.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, having experienced some of the same discrimination Regana's son faces now in my own youth, I can tell you, duty to accommodate isn't just a matter of opinion. It's an absolute. For someone with a disability who succeeds, let them succeed. It's not about us telling them what they should be doing. A professor of mine told me once, a long time ago, do what's you, not what everyone thinks you should be doing. Those words resonated with me. As I got older, I came to realize someone doesn't recognize your skill and your value, it's up to you to demonstrate what you're capable of. The fact is, he succeeded in passing all his classes. It's not up to us to tell him what profession he should or should not be going into. That is the purview of the employer, and it's also incumbent on him to demonstrate that he's just as capable as anyone else. Frankly, the economics of the situation are a little confusing as well. So he took a little longer. That means extra tuition for the school. It means establishing a reputation as one who's willing to work with students with disabilities. But they failed to do so. Therefore, the reputation may become something else. A place where you can go and find yourself locked into someone's opinion of what you should be, rather than giving you the freedom and the potential to explore your own capabilities. As a person with a disability, it's never anyone's place to say, this is the glass ceiling, this is as far as you can go. It's up to you to define your gifts, your capabilities. Try it out before you decide it's impossible, and don't let someone else's imposition, what they think you're capable of, hold you down. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Cheese, please, yes. Cheese, please, you're so fine.
You want to listen all the time. Snarf-tude and Daffodil will spin the hits. It's all cheesy music. They love it to bits. Well, Snarf-tude is the man in the band. Finding cheesy music is his only plan. Daffodil is sugar, but she's also spice. She might be saucy, but she can be pretty nice. All the cheesy music, they can scrounge. You'll hear the favorites in the Limburger Lounge. Play